All right, we're here with Bill Buxton at CHI 2011. And tell us about this place that we're at right here.
Well, I had the privilege of being asked to have this bit of a pack rat. I've had this large collection of stuff over about 30 years I've been collecting, and I show it from time to time, but they invited me to bring it and exhibit it. And we used that with a bunch of the folks from MSR, from the web team and so on, to try and actually make something more than just a collection of gadgets, to actually build a really information and that has a life beyond this. So we used the invitation to exhibit here at CHI as the catalyst to actually really catalog what I have and document things really carefully, the dates and so on and so forth, and make it available on the web in a reliable way, in a way that's just can help raise awareness to a lot of these technologies. And it's been really a lot of work. It's been a labor of love. It's had a bunch of us, about a dozen people, just sweating bricks. It's the closest to doing a startup, the type of experience that I can remember without it being actually a startup, but it was actually great. So we've got a bunch of interactive devices, the things you touch, handhelds mostly. I tend not to collect computers, they're too big, except for pen computers, because I'm really interested in the history of pen computing. So what led up to the tablet PC? And it's pretty funny, because I don't have any tablet PCs here. I stopped at just before the tablet PC, just to show what was leading up.
Yeah.
I actually have a bunch of tablet PCs, I just bring them here so far. But also PDAs, phones. But I've also got a bunch of other things that are just from outside. Do you want to? Let me show you what I mean by that.
Let's see.
I'd rather talk about the stuff that's not obvious. So you sort of say, well, okay, why do I have these Swiss Army knives? I mean, look at this one. This is just the most bizarre thing you can imagine. I mean, it's got 80 different blades. It's got two socket sets on it. It's got two different magnifying glasses, and it's got flashlights. It even has a user manual of how to set up. Because it has, if you notice on the side here, it's got a barometer and a clock and an altimeter and all this sort of stuff. So it's a digital Swiss Army knife, and it's useless. And it's so useless that it's delightful, but only as a collecting item. Right? The only thing fun. And then there's this thing that has almost no functionality, which is the most commonly available, and therefore the most useful. And it's a funny thing, right? The fewer features on the product, the more useful it is, because the more likely that you have it with you and you know how to use it. The more features and the bigger it is, the less likely, because I don't even want that in my briefcase.
Yeah, somewhere along the way they forgot it was a knife.
Yeah, and this one, I'm not going to carry around my pocket, but I might carry around my briefcase.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of talks about this notion that more is not necessarily more. In this case, more is less. More features means less usefulness, except for most people. And it helps us understand in software that layering things on to improve, quote-unquote, the product may actually be destroying it.
Mm-hmm.
And typically you find that when you get up to about 9.0 versions of software that you start to get bogged down, because there's so much stuff that it becomes, to manage that complexity becomes the dominant thing as opposed to the doing features. And so it costs way more to add features that have value to fewer and fewer of your customers, and that's a really interesting dynamic. Now, there's another thing here that I really like, and this is a classic, it's from the 50s, remote control from Zenith. And there's a really interesting lesson here that I think is really valuable for us today, because I can't tell you how many times I've been in meetings in software companies where somebody proposes something and it gets nixed because somebody says, well, you can already do that. Okay, so let's examine that by stepping outside of computers and take something that we all know a lot about, television, and we've used it. Now, when I say we know a lot about, I mean we've had a lot of experience. We may not know what as much as we think. If adding redundant features, things you can already do, is a reason not to do it, then the remote control should not exist, right? Because the remote control, every button on it costs money. The packaging costs money. You've got to manufacture it. You've got to have inventory and all that sort of stuff. And it doesn't do anything you can't already do with the existing buttons on the TV set. And by the way, the buttons on the TV set didn't go away. Total redundant features, why bother? Stupid idea, right? Well, of course not, because it wasn't about the features, it wasn't the buttons. It was about the transaction cost of changing channels. And so we changed the price, not the name of the feature. And it's all about transaction cost. Now, not in dollars and cents, because it actually cost me more money. I have to pay for this. But in terms of the price of inconvenience, in terms of the price of speed of execution, and the chance of making a mistake, I reduced all that. And I get to surf, channel surf, right? Now, this one is interesting, just is that it actually makes these clicks, and the ultrasound of the clicks is what actually was sensed. There was a microphone, and that's where the clicking, the notion of clicking through, came from this generation of remotes. But the other part is, I want to point out that we think about this as just as channel surfing, and that's what the change was, but that's misguided. The ability to change channels by changing the transaction cost for the viewer to change channels fundamentally changed the entire nature of television. It changed the length of commercials, because if they're too long, people would leave and surf. If the commercials were much shorter, you'd stick with them. It changed the nature of commercials. They started trying to make them like informative entertainment, right? And more exciting. It changed the nature of the TV shows themselves, is how fast you edited, how fast the cuts were, and so on. And any student of cinema, if you're a computer scientist and you've written no computers, but you don't know a lot about how the films were made, ask somebody who does know, and they'll tell you, just compare Leave It to Beaver with any of Three's Company or something like that, in terms of the pace and how many shots you go through and how long the camera stays and so on. This is what changed that. Adding a feature you already had. Fascinating. And I would argue that that's true in everything we do in our industry. And that the most important thing is, here's my rule that comes out of that. Because you've got to, what can we learn from the past? That you should not be allowed to propose a new feature to any product unless you affix the price point in terms of transaction cost that's associated with it. Because if you, it would be like, I got this great piece of software, everybody will want it, but it's going to cost $1 million a cut. That's kind of like, of course you wouldn't do it even if a million people wanted it. Now on the other hand, if I had something that would only appeal to 100,000 people, but it costs nothing to manufacture, and that I might make it, because right? It's just easy money if I'm a small company. You can't disassociate, you can't evaluate it, get the value proposition without knowing the cost. Manufacturing from the supplier side, but also the benefit in terms of the transaction cost for the user. And features must have ascribed what is the cost. One of the products I did was for a general purpose walk-up interactive display, and one of the most important specifications was, here's a working prototype, this is the performance model, and the spec was, any employee of General Motors must be able to do this and learn 80% of the functionality in 3 to 5 minutes with a 90% retention a week later, or that is a stop ship bug, even if every line of code is provably correct and even if every feature is in the product. And that completely changes how the engineering team built the product, because engineers are smart, ambitious people, want to show how smart they are. They always want to beat the spec to show that they're better than the spec. And that way they're going to make it even less. They're going to try and get it up to 90% in 2 minutes and 100% retention a week later, right? Because they're going to game the system all the time. What you spec is what you get. Transaction costs are really important. This tells you about it. And stuff like that. So this, I got a globe, right? I can see it better from this side. It's not plugged in yet. I'll get to that shortly. But you start to say, well, what's with this globe? Well, one of the guys at MSR, Benko, was working on these spherical displays, and my team at Alias, we were doing that before. And when we were doing it with a different type of display, and not the same way, Benko's just building great stuff, was I brought this in because it actually is a computerized thing. And it answers a really interesting question. So it's at the stylus, and so you can go and sort of click here and then click there, and it'll tell you the distance between those two places. And you can switch to a different program, and it'll tell you what country it is. So you can click another thing, it'll tell you the population. So this is an interactive display. It just happens to not be a dynamic display at the moment. But this answers the question in some ways. What if you took a Wacom tablet and you made it spherical? What if you had a Wacom tablet that was only spherical, but it was a Cintiq, so it had a display on it as well? What would it be like? I've got a working prototype. I just go in the store and spend it, you know, to eBay or something like that and just buy them on cheaply. I bought this new when it came out. And the neat thing about it is, one of the things we noticed is that when we always thought about holographic or 3D displays before, we were talking about, oh yeah, you can walk around and you can just access other things this way. But the minute you have this as a reference model, so this to me is a sketch. It just happens to be a sampled sketch, sampled from the physical world as opposed to a synthesized sketch. You then realize that this gesture here of navigation, which is similar to what we do on whiteboards and things like that, does rotation, means that I can still keep track of where things are without having to walk around, and people on the other side can still see. So it's just that the insights there, if you figure, let's say this thing costs $200. You figure what my team's time is worth, what would it take to build something that would let me learn that lesson? If you had to build a prototype to learn that lesson and then go back to drawing boards, it's going to cost you several thousand dollars plus months in production time. So you're not going to do it because you're already behind schedule the day you start. Go to eBay now, buy something like that, and bingo. And for almost every product we're working on in as a community, not just at Microsoft, is that there's something out there. Let me show you. This is one of the cooler things that just cracks me up. I spent some time with audio and music technology group at UC Berkeley a couple years ago, and they introduced me to this gadget. And I've got it down here for a reason. So it looks like just two joysticks, right?
Like for an RC plane or something.
Yeah, right? And there's two-dimensional controllers. But no. Watch. I'm going to put it down here. Check this out. These are the handles of the joysticks.
Wow.
But the shaft encoder, there's a shaft encoder on the spool, the spring-loaded spool of this wire. So this is a 3D joystick.
Wow.
So I've got a 3D joystick there, so I can get X, Y by the angle, but I can get Z by the distance. And I have two of them, so I now have 6 degrees of freedom.
Wow.
And this was designed for a golf game. It's a video game controller. And just before the Wii and then Kinect came out, they were trying to get gesture-based controls. So these things hooked onto a little holster that you put the head of your golf club in, so you'd be sitting like that in this golf game and swing like that, and because of it knew the distance between these two things,
mm-hmm.
and from your initial point and started swinging, you could do the gesture analysis that could actually then do the physics for the golf ball, and you could play this virtual golf on your TV. But we've been using this just for playing with hooking this up to some mobile phones just to try different things about using quick space because there's no lag.
Yeah.
But it's just knowing about these things, which is just delightful. But that is just the big brother of these things, right? The typical joysticks.
So one of the things I've noticed about the gadgets in here is that a common denominator is many of them were very innovative when they were released.
That's right.
But they weren't necessarily successful.
Yeah. Timing's kind of important.
And talk a little bit about how innovation and success intersect or separate.
So again, it comes down to economics. Cost, it's too premature. So PDAs didn't succeed, not because they weren't successful. Come on over, we'll look at some PDAs and you can get a sense of it. There were a lot of early, if we start here with these types of PDA functions. I mean, this is brilliant. This is 1984. This is a touchscreen that lets you enter data alphabetic. You just draw the characters on here and you can enter. It even had auto completion on the names and so on and so forth for your address book. This thing had, you could draw, it's got a pen, you could actually draw here. There's a touchpad here as well, so you could do that. All really great things. We had the Newton down here, and then we had this thing. This is a version of the Zoomer that was the first product that Palm made, and then they put it out. And it was kind of a failure, but it was pretty neat. Why did the Palm Pilot do so well? In fact, why did the Palm Pilot, at the very time that Microsoft was being accused of being that nobody could compete with them, and so it just wasn't fair and stuff like that, and everybody's whining and so on and so forth, I just want to point out that the Palm came out with this handheld PDA device at the same time we were trying to do the CE devices, and let's put it mildly, they gave us a serious run for money. And they proved that if you had the right stuff, that anybody could come, no matter how small you were, could be a real competitor to a large company, whether it be Microsoft or any other of the big companies today. There's an existence proof. If you try and go head-to-head and do the same thing they're doing, you're probably not going to win. But if you're in some new space and you innovate, what was the innovation? Everybody talks about the Palm, that the innovation was, oh, well, it's small and it only had a few functions and it was graffiti or this and that. No, no, no. All that was true, but there's lots of other devices that had those attributes. What the Palm Pilot had was hot sync. And they understood that the thing that was holding us up wasn't the technology. It wasn't the quality of the address book. It wasn't the quality of the calendar or any of those things. It wasn't that it was too big or clunky. It was that if I lost it, I was hosed. It was how much time it took me to get my address into there, because I had to do everything on this thing by hand. In 1984, this was brilliant, what you got your stuff in it. But if I lost it, all that work, it cost me a huge amount of time to get it in. And if I lost it, if the batteries died, I had to start all over again. The Palm Pilot understood that it was my confidence and the amount of risk I had of my data. The Palm Pilot with HotSync said, if you lose this, that you can photocopy your entire address book, your entire calendar, everything, all your personal notes, do lists, in one button push in less than 60 seconds. And furthermore, any changes you make on your computer will be updated there and vice versa. It took the risk out completely, completely within a module of it, how often your interval of hot syncing. And furthermore, it meant the minute you bought it, you plug it in, push that button, and you're off and running. You didn't have to enter anything except push that button. And that changed the game. And recognizing that the failure of the predecessors was not due to any of bad ideas like the character recognition, but because you didn't have hot sync. If I lose my Palm Pilot and any of the devices since, I'm not the depreciated cost of the hardware and maybe the entries that entered that day, but everything else is backed up. Now, that doesn't mean if I come to this, there's not something really valuable. Because if I can enter addresses and text in this by just drawing on the surface, and by the way, my wristwatch was made at exactly the same time, has the same character recognizer, and it's from the same company, also 1984, touch screen on my watch. I just write the numbers in the operators to get the calculator.
Nice.
Now, what can I learn from this? I could say, well, that's a failure, obviously a bad idea. No, it's not a bad idea at all. What's great about this and this is they teach us from 1984 that I can tweet and I can SMS while I can look at you, because I can touch write just as I can touch type, because I just write each character on top of the other because I'm drawing the characters as opposed to trying to find these little keys down here. And in this day of where tweeting and so on is so much a part of the social networking, there's a really important lesson here, because in almost none of our current smartphones and so on and so forth can we do what this could do in 1984. Now, let me really put that two really important points here. Very, very few of the people, if any, well, there must be some, of the people who are designing these things today, these newfangled, really touch, on the touch bandwagon, right? Everything's, since 2007, everything's got a hand touch. Very few of them know that these exist. Those who know that they exist probably don't have one, probably have never used one, and therefore they're unaware of that lesson. If they get one, they can actually learn the lesson.
So there's still things you can learn from these, what many would consider ancient devices.
Okay, 1984 wristwatch that has character recognition and a touchscreen for $99.95. And then you think, 1994, what happened there? That's the year the Macintosh first came out. That's how old this watch is. That's how old that calculator is. I bought that as soon as it came out. But it's even more important than that. 1984 is 17 Moore's laws ago. That means a chip in this watch that let them do it for $99.95, that lets us tweet without looking. If that chip of the same size existed today at the same price, would have over 130,000 times the compute power. And that says technology is not the bottleneck here. It lets us do more things. But this watch and that says Technology is not the bottleneck. Our bottleneck is our knowledge of history and taking advantage of it. Here's what you need to do. If we knew as much about the history of things, the licks that we could cop to make better design music, right, as Jimi Hendrix knew about the blues, or Keith Richards knows about the Delta and Southern blues, if we knew as much as we know about our music heroes, every musician has that knowledge of their heroes of music. If we had that knowledge about our past, as they have about theirs, our design would be way better informed. And if there's one lesson here, it's that very thing. These things, every one of these things has something to teach us. And one of the main lessons is, invention doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's all about evolution. And then if we look at things like the transistor radio that inspired the iPod, or the IBM smartphone that inspired much of the iPhone and then smartphones and so on, that's a really important lesson. And there's an economic lesson here too, is that this is one form of prototyping. eBay is one of the best prototyping tools you can get. This thing, the Data Rover, this was done by Bill Atkinson and I'm blanking the name for the two of the key people from Apple that left, and they started this company called General Magic. And this is one of the early devices that let you do email on a messaging on a really portable device. But, you know, every year practically a student or somebody comes up and says, wow, you know, the graphical interfaces and stuff like that, all these things are all 2D, they're all flat, and, you know, what if we had 3D and perspective, and so you can move things around and have desks and go through doors, and then you can use spatial memory to remember. And you know what? Sorry, been there, done that. $27 on eBay, you could buy, I bought that brand new from some surplus thing, and it had all that. It had a 3D rendering of a desk with a Rolodex on it, a phone, and a filing cabinet, and drawers, and a door. You go through the door into the hallway, and then down the hallway of the library, you get the dictionaries and all this sort of stuff. You had storage cabinets. You had a games room. You had, and you touched the phone to get the phone function. You touched the Rolodex to get your cards, and they graphically. So I'm not saying it was right or wrong. I'm just saying that if somebody thinks that's a useful way to go, if you knew the history, you could actually just go find one of those, work with it well to see what worked, what didn't, how could you tweak it to make it better. But like Newton and others have said, that all the great ideas are built, you know, on the shoulders of the giants who came before. But you got to know who the giants are and what they have to offer to be able to get on their shoulders. Otherwise, you got to climb the whole way from the bottom by yourself when there's an escalator right there waiting for you if you just knew that A, there was such a thing, and then how to find it. And I think the challenges we have in terms of technology today are such that I don't think we can afford to ignore those elevators. It's good to hike. I'm a mountain climber, so I don't take the ski lift to the top of the mountain and say I've climbed the mountains. That's okay. But I can get my exercise because the mountains are so high that I don't mind taking off the boring part of the bottom to do the hard part. It's just, I don't know, metaphor breaks down. There's a lot to learn. And anyhow, it's always just a delight to see the range of creativity and innovation of people who work in our profession and celebrate that and then let them set the bar that we set for ourselves. Look at the bar that they set for themselves and what some of them did. And say, what would be as amazing today as this was in 1984? And if they could take that big of a leap then, shouldn't that be the bar that I'm setting right now? And for all of us, what if we did that? It would be pretty cool.
So I've been here for a couple of hours, and one of the things I've noticed is there's a lot of people going by putting their nose up against the glass and smiling. What's going to happen to this? How can people continue to enjoy this going forward?
Great question. So we have this spectacular web team at Microsoft Research, and I got to tell you, nobody told them to do this. They just volunteered. They heard about this, and they just said, hey, can we play? That's one of the things this stuff does, right? It just inspires people. It's like, wow. And they just came on in a way that I could never have dreamed about. And so I photographed all this stuff really carefully, and I've scanned a whole bunch of stuff, and they've built a website that's just beyond my wildest dreams. And so we're still adding to it, and we're going to continue to add to it, both in terms of the size of the collection and but the contents. All the computers that we can get running us up there, we're going to make video, get the videos down and add the videos so you can actually see how they worked and document the 3D information in this thing so you don't just have blank screens. It's not about the object. And interviews with people who made them and so on and so forth will build up this archive. It's online right now. If you just go to Microsoft, if you just typed in Bing or any search engine, Microsoft Research, you'll find research.microsoft.com. And then if you just type in search there, Buxman Collection, you'll find all this stuff. It runs on your mobile phone. It runs on your, if you have a desktop computer or a laptop computer, it actually, there's this thing called Pivot Viewer, which is, again, an MSR technology that's just spectacular. It lets you slice and dice and sort things by date, by type, by manufacturer, by price, all this sort of stuff. It's very, very neat. And I guess the other thing I'd sort of say is that by way of active involvement, I'm accepting donations. I don't mean for money, but there's a lot of things in this class. I don't want all kinds of bizarre computers, but there's really important input devices that I'd love to include in the collection, but I want the physical device. I don't want to borrow it. I want it to be added to the collection. And my commitment here is that we will do our best to make sure that the things in the collection are available, find a way that they can just be available to people who are serious researchers so that they're not lost. That we want to capture the stuff before they're irretrievably dead. But I can't whine and complain about people not knowing this stuff if it's not available.
Yeah.
And so what we've done, myself as individually, but actually far more with this wonderful collection of people I work with, at MSR and colleagues from other places as well, all just jumped on board, have been very supportive, often from competitors of Microsoft. We've got this thing going that will actually capture not the whole history of computers or anything like that, but at least at this part, we can start to get that covered so that there's fewer excuses not to know it.
Well, thanks for showing us this incredible collection.
That's fun. And so, obviously, this is a lot of people can't be here, so just go hit the Pivot Viewer. Here's the funny thing. I've got to finish with this. This is why I love my job, and I love the people I work with. Nobody in the world knows this stuff better than I do. I collect it, right? I've lived with this stuff for 30 years. And I'm not blowing smoke when I say the following thing. This is really, really true. When I got when they sent me the URL so I could try the Pivot Viewer and I got to dive in to my own stuff, it was like unbelievable. I learned a lot of stuff because of what they'd done. And this is really important. Right? This is the part that no matter how expert you are in your own field, if you have the right partners who bring another way so you can bring different eyes to the stuff that you think you know, it's remarkable how much you can learn. And man, I learned from this project, I've learned so much about what I thought was teaching. No. I've learned more from this than probably anybody else will. But I hope that's not true.
Thanks, Bill.
My pleasure.